I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Jade from Birmingham, and you're listening to Dame Baptiste Questions Everything. Okay, so my question is, if we've evolved to no longer need them, why do we still have baby toes? Here comes the show, and thanks for listening. And remember, question everything.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Dame Baptiste Questions Everything, a podcast where myself, comedian, writer, and occasional actor Dame Baptiste, my producer friend, Howard Cohen, a.k.a. The Hizzer,
hello,
and a mix of very special guests pose the questions that need to be asked, and we are talking everything from...
Everything from Jade, from Birmingham's question, if we no longer need them, why do we still have baby toes? Dane, it's an evolution question this week from a listener. Where'd you stand on
great
this?
Great question. Thank you very much, Jade, for coming. Combining both intellectual question as well as a cutesy poo question with baby toes. It's a good question because the other one is why men still have nipples if they don't lactate. Mm. And I think, you know, maybe men having titties and toes is, I can't speak for, I can only speak for my gender in that I believe that maybe baby toes are there to keep people, I think they're there to keep people humble. I think when you stub your toe on the corner of like a skirting board or on a bedpost or on a door, I think we all suffer a pain that we all realize that neither our parents nor the deities which we worship can protect us from. And so your toes are there to remind you that you are still human, and that even though almost everything is now at the human fingertips, your toes still haven't got it sorted out yet. So be humble.
The actual scientific reason is that we used to climb trees, right? Yeah. And we don't obviously need to do that anymore. And those toes are therefore defunct, unless you happen to climb trees using your feet in that kind of way. But I'm not sure you do.
Which is true. I could pick up a pound coin with my toes, so that's useful.
Jade, we hope that answers your question. And suffice to say, on this podcast, we ask and answer all the questions, don't we?
Absolutely, Howard. We are not ones to tiptoe around the subject. I'm so sorry, everyone, including you, Jade. I'm normally funny, and this show's normally good. And if you do like it, please rate and review on Apple Podcasts or follow us on Spotify, and you'll never miss an episode. Or subscribe to us on Acast, the world's biggest podcast network, where you can hear all of the questions from all of our very special guests. With that being said, on today's show, our guest is a comedian, presenter, actor, and writer, among many other things. He was nominated 4 times for the Edinburgh Comedy Award before winning Best Show in 2010. He became the first comedian to win the Edinburgh Award and the Melbourne Comedy Festival's Barry Award in 1 year. On TV, he is known as the host of the 3 series of Live at the Electric and regularly appears on Live at the Apollo, Celebrity Juice, and I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here to this day. And now his first novel, The Humorist, was nominated for literary prizes. He has also written, directed, and starred in 3 plays, but he has his own amazing podcast, which I've also appeared on, called Boys Don't Cry, which I highly recommend. If you don't know, you better get to know. Please welcome to the show, Mr. Russell Kane.
Hello.
Hello.
I mean, from a question and answer point of view, I would say Evil Genius is a more relevant plug. That is the BBC podcast I'm doing, where we take sort of historical figures and throw out unknown, sort of previously unknown facts that blow people's minds. Mm. So we'll take people that everyone worship, like a sort of a Gandhi or Diego Maradona or Picasso or whoever, and I let off little fact bombs around them, confuse my panel, and then they have to vote evil or genius at the end. So it could be a distant cousin of this podcast in that loads of juicy new facts revealed throughout the show.
Lovely. And have you found out any particularly horrific things about people, Russell? Or?
All the time. I mean, that is the purpose. Unless we're doing a reverse episode where we're taking someone who it's fashionable to revile, and then I let off genius bombs around them to confuse the panel. I mean, the Gandhi episode always sticks in my mind, and I get trolled regularly once a week as I throw mud at an icon. But Gandhi obviously. It was quite an intense week of my life.
And he slept with underage girls.
Yes, Gandhi used to test, that's correct. Gandhi used to test his celibacy.
Wow.
By sleeping naked under a duvet with his 19-year-old niece and emerging the next day going, I didn't fuck her. And everyone was like, legend. that's what he did. That's not the worst thing he did, though, Dane. Do you know how racist Gandhi was?
Yeah, he was very racist, yeah.
But not just like a normal racist dad.
No, apartheid racist.
Yeah, he got it put through Parliament so that Indian people wouldn't have to queue with African people in the same queue. This is your robe-wearing Muslims and Hindus unite Gandhi.
Wow.
Yeah, well, that's why people get shot in the chest, isn't it?
So I've got loads like that, but it's not just about heavy political figures. We do, like, we did James Bond yesterday. We recorded it. We sometime now and again we'll do like a fictional episode. I think were you on once, Dane?
Yeah. I'm trying to remember which one I did.
Twice. Did you do Father Christmas? Or am I misremembering that?
I did Father Christmas and I did. Is that the Whitney Houston maybe?
Yeah. Father Christmas episode was an absolute shocker. Turns out it's a nonce that breaks into houses looking for children.
Well, you know. Who really likes kids that don't belong to them, Russell? That is the question. You have to question any person who wants to spend time around children they didn't give birth to. I want to drive a school bus. Well, unless you're drugged off your tits like Otto is on The Simpsons, I'm very suspicious.
Exactly.
So, you know.
I mean, I don't trust people that want to spend time around their own children. That's weird.
Exactly.
I've actually been thinking about that quite a lot recently because I've got this baby that me and my wife made, Russell. He lives here now. And as a baby, it's kind of, you know, he's quite fun, really. And obviously, he's going to evolve into a proper person. And I imagine that's going to be more maintenance in some ways. Whereas the maintenance right now is like, you know, he doesn't know how not to shit himself. You know, that's kind of quite simple maintenance, yeah. Isn't it?
He'll revisit that phase when he's between 18 and 41. Only when he's on the beer.
Yeah.
In his defence, the reason why he's living in your house was at his old house, he used to see you poking your dick through the window. So, you know, I'd probably be house hunting too after a few months of that.
Yeah. It's probably time for a question, isn't it, Dane, as the format of this show dictates before my wife has a go at me.
Yeah. She won't have a go. Shout out to Tara again.
Yeah.
But yes, it's time for a question. Russell Kane, thank you so much for coming on the show. Love your work. As our very esteemed guest, we are invited to ask the first question, which can be any type of question which we like to discuss. And then Howard will do the same. And then lather, rinse, repeat. I do it one more time. Then we can find out more about your amazing works alongside Boys That Cry, Evil Genius, and all of your amazing wares. Then everybody have a nice time. How's that sound?
I've got one. So as a sort of covered in hummus lefty comedian, obsessed with identity and everything like that, as we all are, there's one that gets ignored. So my question is, to what extent do you think this trait that you're born with, you can't change it, you're born with this trait, you've got one, a version of this identity, to what extent does it decide your income level, your life outcomes, how much poverty you will live in, what type of sexual success you'll have and how you will die and live. And that is height. You can't control how tall you're going to be. And by all accounts, well, I'm going to let you answer it first. What do you think the correlation is?
Interesting.
For a man, we're talking for men here. I should have said for men.
Particularly with men, I think there is, it can be a very big determinant of your the way your life will turn out, particularly because there are certain aesthetics and connotations that are associated with height. I know this because I come from a community whereby it's now become a very common narrative from women in the dating marketplace that if a man is under 6 feet, then...
Dane, you sound like you've been made in Alaska. Dane got 5,000. Now programmed for mating.
I heard it from the dating marketplace. But yeah, I think, height plays a massive difference in terms of how you might necessarily be treated because... I'd say at least romantically and sexually, it is presumed that if you are a taller man, that you have a larger amount of, you'll be naturally more masculine and predisposed to be a better sexual partner, have a bigger phallic size or bigger dick than your daughter counterparts.
Well, that's a different question. Does height correlate with genital size? And of course, they're on two different systems, which is why someone who's in a wheelchair can still get a boner because the genitals sit on a different system to the glands and hormones that dictate your height. So sadly, you can be 7'1" with an absolute acorn.
Absolutely, but by the time we get to somebody's home or to their hotel,
it's true.
You know, true. They may not have checked by then, you know. So I think, but at the same time, I think what it is that even though they're not correlated, there is a presumption that they are correlated, that if his hands are big,
right,
we are big, everything must be big. And so again, you're given somewhat more grace than your shorter counterparts. I think that is on a very superficial level, that is generally the consensus. But I think a lot of the time there's always going to be, I suppose, exceptions to this rule, or because I personally believe the issue is more about stature than it is about height. Hmm. But I think height does play a big part. Again, like I'm speaking from my own community experience, is you may be pushed in particular sports. You know, I meet most people and they're like, "Do you play basketball?" And I'm like, "Not really." And they're like, "But why? 'Cause I don't like it." But you know, it's presumed that I'd be into basketball.
Well, we all know Tom Davis, right? On this, all three of us, I'm sure, have spent time with Tom, and Tom often talks about the pain of being a really tall bloke, which is, you know,
yeah, there's a threshold, yeah. So yeah, but moving to the point as well, is that if you are over 6 foot, then you know you seem to be in a small window of appreciation, and I'd say that runs from about 6'1" or 6 foot to like 6'4". Once you go into 6'5" and then 6'6", where you will be classified as a giant, then again, it means your life will be very different, where you tend to stand out a lot more because you are classified as a giant. You probably have to field a lot more asinine questions with regards to your height, and back to what we're discussing about the correlation between that and penis size that most people have to listen to. And, you know, I think that has an effect on your life expectancy as well for circulatory reasons.
Short guys live longer as a rule.
They live alone.
You have a whole life of being tall, but then when you die, I'm hoovering all the pom-pom in the nursing home, is what I'm saying.
But Russell, I've got to ask Russell a question, which is...
Circle of life.
Russell, you know, our listeners may know you, they may not know you, but they also might not know, you know, how, do you want me asking how tall you are?
5'10", the exact UK average. Not that average really means anything. It doesn't mean there's lots of 5'10" people in the UK. It just means it's not the median height of in the UK. It's the average. As
do you feel being at the average height has affected your life in a specific way?
Definitely, I have been out with girls that were 5'9". I've been out with one girl that was 5'9". So as soon as she's in heels, she was taller than me. And I had an issue with that. And I was disgusted because I'm like, you know, like, oh my God, gender's constructed, man. I mean, yeah, we can evolve. We can become super beings. And then I'm like, the most basic monkey behavior, girl bigger than me threatened. And I put like buffalo heels on just so I could feel taller. There were these platform shoes called Buffaloes, these retro platform. I mean, that's pathetic, isn't it? So insecure as a man. So for me, it's average height is not an issue for stand-up, I don't think, because you're on a stage. No one really has a perception of how tall you are on a stage, but definitely in everyday life. I mean, this has been studied, if you want me to spoil it and give you the answer.
Please let us know.
It's been studied. Interestingly, it's not as dramatic for women. The life outcomes, the difference in height is not as dramatic for women as it is in men.
I think it's somewhat of a double standard. And I have a bit pertaining to this in that, you know, yeah, men don't even factor in women's height, in, whether it's genetically or romantically. And, you know, there are some gender-based, there's a gender-based dichotomy in terms of what are the connotations of height are between the two.
Right. But interestingly, the BMI, if you like, if you want to be impolite, how fat we are, that plays in the other direction. So BMI has less of an impact on men's socioeconomic status, although it does have an impact, than it does for women. And I've got the maths here, if you can bear with me. So a standard one deviation in BMI, so I think like you're supposed to be, I don't know what, 24 BMI. So if you go up one, and you're 25 BMI as a man, you will lose on average £210 a year income.
Wow.
So that's really easy to understand. Ooh. A woman will lose nearly £2,000 of income for every BMI point she goes up. And we spend our whole lives obsessing about gender equality, racial equality. I bang on about class until I'm hoarse from it, boring everyone with my Essex background. Behind the scenes, just carrying a bit of belly fat will knock £2,000 off your income from prejudiced employers who do not reward you because you're not slim enough. It's crazy that we don't talk about this. Also, from a comedian's point of view, interesting and funny, and there's loads you could do stand-up about it. And then, of course, in height, so if we say to make a standard measurement point, they've used 6.3 centimetres for men. And so education the same, everything controlled out, everything the same. For every 6.3 centimetres, it's an extra £2,000 to £4,000 income a year.
Wow.
It's crazy. If you said that, if I said, oh, in our firm, if you are Bangladeshi, you will earn $2,000 a year more than someone who is Indian, I'd be nicked. But if I can quite happily pay a man who is 2 inches taller, $2,000 a year, why is no one talking about this?
Well, and it's also the same with beautiful people, isn't it? I mean, I'm not a beautiful person to look at.
Harder to measure, though. Harder to prove, harder to measure.
But I reckon there's a correlation, though, eh?
Definitely the fitness is something else. But fitness you can control a little bit. You can work out. You can, if you want, do plastic surgery. You can colour your hair. You can get hair implants. You can change the way you look. At the time of recording, pretty difficult to change your height.
Yeah. Well, it's also that thing of, I guess, with the fitness side of things, that there's the potential for, you know, just to be really blunt about it, if that's okay. Like, you know, if you turned up to an interview and you were physically out of shape and you kind of, you know, were breathing heavily, having walked over to the, you know, the interview room, then that obviously has an impact. Also, if you feel physically fit, you're kind of more confident, right? That's a natural, I think, impact of being, you know.
But you'd be better off if we're both walking towards the interview and you're wheezing and unfit, but 6'3", and I'm trim and fit as fuck and 5'8". You'll probably still get the job, even if we both have equal education.
Wow, that's shocking, isn't it? You think?
Height privilege, mate. Why is no one talking about height privilege?
Is this what the fuck? Because I can't think of a purer thing that you are born with and can't change, that can sit alongside. I mean, gender, you could even change your gender now if you want to, mm-hmm. If you feel that way inclined, if you don't identify in a traditional binary way. But there's very few things you can be born with, that truly, truly biological born with, are not your fault, that you can't change, you should not be judged on. And it's always blown my mind. And the more I look into it, I'm sort of getting stand-up angry, not genuinely angry, because I don't feel like it's impacted on my life. Maybe it has. Maybe I'd have a few more houses. I don't know.
It's a weird one as well, isn't it? Because I definitely feel that the tall people I know have been impacted by being so tall, and in some respects really positively, and in other respects it can bring them a pressure that they don't deal with very well. I don't know if you have experienced, because Dane, you're tall, right? How tall are you?
How tall are you, Dane?
I am 6'1".
That's it. That's the dream.
Yeah. I mean, it took a while to achieve this dream because I was a very late developer so far as height within my family. My dad is also 6'1". My grandfather, my maternal grandfather, I believe, is 6'2", 6'2½ maybe. And I think my paternal grandfather is also 6 foot.
You come from like a wealthy background, Dane. What's your history? Because the correlation is this, which is what some people say anyway. This is where we're in speculation, but there's no doubt about it. So my granddad is 5'7". My granddad's alive and well, my mum's dad. My granddad's 5'7", 5'8", and I'm 5'10", and my daughter's already tall. So you can change within 2 or 3 generations with good nutrition and eating the right food and not starving and shit like that. People get taller. So if you go to Parliament, for example, or if you go to Oxford University to do a gig, there'll be a lot more tall boys there because of generations of privilege. Mm-hmm. So it tends to be the case that the taller you are, the more privilege your family has had. But I don't know if that's the same cross-culturally.
Because of height is seen as a preferential feature when people are factoring for potential partners, then having a certain height will predispose you to having better choices, both romantically, or I say financially and romantically. So I'd say, you know, lower middle or upper working class, I'd say, by your standards.
But the interesting is when twins get split up and one twin gets brought up in a slightly poorer household, there won't be much in it, but the posher twin will be millimetres taller. And they're genetically fucking identical.
In Africa, like, one of the methods of colonialism was encouraging women not to breed with tall men from tribes like the Maasai or from, like, tribes and Nubian tribes in South Sudan, because of a way of trying to, you know, destroy the masculinity amongst the continent. It was encouraged that women would mate with like pygmies and members of the foie, so they'd be smaller. Because like if you look, because I think pygmies are more native to like South Central, like Rwanda and Republic of Congo, like further down towards the south. And people never used to be that short. Like for example, like the Zulus and like South African men used to be really tall, but there was an attempt, like as there was like in Brazil, to kind of remove that element of masculinity and blackness from the gene pool. Yeah. based on
that would add up. I'm reading a really brilliant book on diet and why we all got fat around 1960 at the moment, and they were talking about traditional African diets back in the day, and everyone's like, oh, we started farming because there wasn't enough food, that's why we got agriculture. And it's absolute bullshit. By all accounts, up until like the 1700s, 1800s, the place was fucking running amok with game. Same on these islands as well before farming started. There's fucking deer, buffalo, we're eating meat, milk, fat, which is why everyone was so tall, because there was shitloads of stuff to eat. As soon as we started farming, everyone started shrinking because we started eating bagels and shit.
Nothing wrong with a bagel from a Cohen, I can tell you. Well, you know, top of the bread food chain.
Wheat runs out. Yeah. This is when we get on the cycle of famine and feast. This, people think, oh, it's what must have always been like in Africa and Europe, in fact, but it wasn't. Back in the day, before farming concentrated wealth onto a few people, there was shitloads of stuff. We'd open our front door, I could chuck a spear out, drag a deer through, venison for dinner, bring it
Lovely.
On.
Lovely. Yeah. I think it's an amazing question, Russell, the height thing. And I think maybe our listeners could go away and think about the next time they're judging people for their height, the impact it may have had on them. Because I definitely think short people get it, you know, get a lot of shit, don't they? That's for sure.
Yeah, man. Every day in the news at the moment, quite rightly so, we're talking about unconscious bias. Mm. This is bias that is buried and invisible. It's not even just unconscious. I don't think anyone even knows it's there. Yeah. But it's every graph, everything you can track, health, longevity, income, how successful you are with ladies, all of it. And for girls, get it from BMI. So what the fuck? But BMI, like I say, BMI, at least you can get some hold on. Yeah. Although there's a lot of argument about how much it is genetically determined versus eating too much. And at the moment, the debate seems to suggest there's fuck all you can do if your genes are telling you to overeat. It's the other way around to what people think. People think that people who are overweight because they overeat. In fact, they overeat because they're overweight because of it's a genetic issue. So BMI is not as simple as people think, but you still can do some shit. But height, forget it.
Mm. Yeah. It's what did you call it before, Dane?
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
The height privilege.
Height privilege. Hashtag height privilege. Let's see if our listeners get involved. But thank you, Russell, for bringing that question to our show. Wonderful question. I'm going to steer us in a slightly different direction for my question, if that's okay, guys. But that was a beauty, and I love the fact you had the answer, Russell. That's something that we don't often have on this show, right, Dane?
And it's a British study. If people want to look it up, it's in the BMJ. It was studied. You'll find the study. And very recently as well, within the last 4 or 5 years, the BMJ actually looked at this, and it was a decent-sized sample as well. Mm. It was 120,000 men, and they tried to control out class and all the other things you can think of.
Amazing. Well, check it out, listeners. And I am going to steer us in a direction of a conversation that I think a lot of people would be asking me to facilitate on this show. My question, and this podcast is being released in late March in 2021. And this is a conversation that will have happened for years and years and years, and is arguably more pertinent to be having now than ever before. And that question is, what should be the future of the British monarchy? And I actually had a listener message me earlier to say, are you guys going to talk about what's been going on with Meghan, Harry, Oprah, and the rest of them? And I could not think of two more brilliantly minded people than yourselves to hear discuss this issue. Russell, I'd love you to kick us off.
I feel like we need the most toxic part of this whole conversation, obviously, is the when Meghan was talking, not just about being suicidal, but when there was a question about what shade, what colour this baby would be. I think that's the thing everyone's talking about. That's, for me, was the mic drop moment. Oprah's jaw hit the floor. Until we know at what level that question was asked, we don't know what damage has been done. It would be like feeling a little jiggle on the Titanic and me and Dane going, that might be an iceberg, might not. Should we abandon ship anyway? If it's high enough up the food chain, and some of us suspect it might be, it's a totally different conversation. It's, I could think, a death blow for the institution. So cards on the table, I work with something called the Prince's Trust, and they do such amazing work, like really, really good work with people that really, really need it. I don't just do it like to appear at a posh dinner and eat a vol au vent. I do actually believe in it. So I'm really conflicted about going in with both guns. The one thing I'm willing to put out there, and which I probably will do, I've got a stand-up gig tonight, a filmed one, which I'm definitely going to put it down on film, is the fucking everyone focusing on Meghan and Harry when Andrew is getting away with noncing at the side. That, to me, I can't get my head around. Why are we getting so angry because Harry, the selfish bastard, wanted to raise his baby in private? I've never heard such disgusting, abusive behaviour in my life. Meanwhile, Andrew's still polishing his HRH at the side going, where are the girls at? So that I can't get my head around.
The issue is about human beings and our fixation on either singularities or our need to attach ourselves to ideals. So it's like, you know, the idea of monarchy might not necessarily be a bad thing, but it's what makes up what we are defining as monarchy. Because even though we're saying like, oh, you know, what's wrong with the royal family is, I mean, who knows? Because they are a family, and, you know, that's one type of family, and we don't know what that's like. At the same time, you know, there is an entire, there are several institutions that come under the umbrella term of monarchy that, you know, these people don't necessarily have any say in or any interaction with, but, you know, they are also, they're going to be the lightning rod for any scrutiny as well as any praise as an institution. I would say personally, I think in a world where particularly a lot of the people who are openly supportive of the monarchy and traditionalists who support the idea of monarchy and commonwealth and colonialism are also the people that are largely outspoken against the evils of socialism and welfare states. And so they're, by that same token, if you are happy, there are also some people that are so outspoken about being atheists and stuff. So I'm like, if you are that outspoken about a free economy where no one gets a handout, then I'm happy for you guys to have a monarchy, but I feel like it's time to cut them off. I don't mind if they exist in principle for the sake of pomposity or ecotourism as they're normally justified by, but I just don't have to pay for it anymore. Because when Kate and William got married, I was working in Westminster. So not only am I working just to be able to afford to work there, but the thing I'm paying for and catering is right next door, and I'm not even fucking invited. So
you will be to the next one, though, Dane. Sir Dane, I should say.
I don't doubt it. But yeah, I just think what can be done with the monarchy is that it's like, who is the monarchy? Is another question.
It's a fucked up, weird. It's a weird idea, isn't it? That just because you fell out of a certain fanny, you're going to run the country.
Not actually run the country, but just have a kind of an unparalleled place within society.
What is their place already? That confuses me, because on the one hand, I think it's crazy. Like, people are like, the royal family. You know, we're supposed to exalt this to a certain level and elevate their status to another level. But they're fucking in Hello magazine, blood. You can't be in the same magazine as a Kardashian and people still believe in the concept of monarchy. I guess, like I said, due to, like, you know, my lineage, or, you know, I guess the royal family, the lineage has to be traced by God or by kings and queens and nobles and stuff. And you're telling me because someone got a surgeon to make their bum bigger, they're going to be in the same magazine as a monarch or a regent that's supposed to be the God himself.
But you got, there's a bit of that with stand-ups as well. Like we have this sort of status as these lofty speakers of the truth, which we wrap up in humour. It can be really powerful and people hang on our every word. I mean, half the things I talk about, I don't have a degree. The only thing I should be doing stand-up about is English literature, really. So I've got all this status. Now and again, we do make mistakes. I mean, I can remember like I was doing this Edinburgh show, like cutting through all the nonsense of the world, calling power to account. And then the same month I appeared on the cover of Reg Transfers Monthly, which is the magazine for registration plate transfers.
Russell Kane.
Just so I can get a free plate.
I've told you before in several occasions when we meet, if you're going to come on here and throw that achievement in my face, I will ask you to leave, sir. I will get there one fucking day.
It's well worth a Google. It's me across the bonnet of a Mercedes holding KAN333E.
Amazing. I mean, it's such a divisive time this is now for this conversation, right? Which is why I wanted to bring it to you guys. And I tell you the thing that I don't know. Look, I really wouldn't ever kind of disparage, particularly the work you talked about doing, Russell. That respect for doing that and respect that charity. But there is one thing that I'm really tired of regarding the entire conversation, and that's how toxic a lot of the media use the monarchy for. The way they use them is this blind patriotism. You know, someone said to me the other day, like they were a bit tired of hearing the national anthem, and I was like, fucking right. Like, God Save the Queen is like, I'm there's two things I disagree with there already, really, which is one, the God bit. And, you know, if there is one, the number one priority, I don't know if it's necessarily that, you know, I find that way.
It would make a good film though, wouldn't it? I'd have Tom Cruise playing God and Helen Mirren play the Queen. Beats fuck out of everyone.
I just think it's just really hit home how, you know, we look at America with very, you know, kind of like, oh, it's so unpleasant over there, the way the press works. It's just, you look at it here with the monarchy and it's no wonder they fucking left the country, man. Like, who can blame them?
I never understood what they were so angry with Harry and Meghan about. Like, taking the sort of the racial subtext out of it for a second, people were just so annoyed with the pair of them for leaving. And they're like, but here's all the money for Frogmore Cottage. They gave it back. They don't want it. They've not asked for anything and they just fucked off. Like, as far as I can tell, they're not taking anything.
They haven't taken anything. And that's what annoys people, is that, you know, in the same way that they have built up this blind idolatry and this blind worship of these archaic ideas of nationalism and patriotism, like the monarchy. When people see people in power turning their backs on this privilege, that makes them upset, because we can remove, I say to people, we can remove color from the issue of Harry versus Meghan. What the bottom line is that you have a country, you have a capitalist Western system where most people realize that their lives won't be particularly remarkable. The way people rationalize their day-to-day working through life, especially, for example, if you are a working class white person living in the UK, there is a large percent chance that there are members of your family that may still be illiterate in an English-speaking country, the English-speaking country. Mm-hmm. Also, following the credit crunch and just, you know, just normal economic machinations, you're not going to become a millionaire. Most people know this. The way you're able to rationalize this and be able to not have a breakdown or demand for the removal of your oppressors or your rulers is by being able to attach yourself to more prestigious ideas. You can be like, well, I am not going to do much in my own life, but I'm a part of the British Empire. My appearance and aesthetic resembles that of my superiors much closer than my black and white, black or brown counterparts. And therefore, I am a subject of the Queen. People derive a level of self-esteem from that. If they don't have that, and people will have the accountability of themselves to manage their life achievements, then it's very hard for people to stomach. And I'd say for a lot of women in this country who have vitriol towards Meghan Markle, it's because an American girl came from America and got to marry a prince, and it's never going to fucking happen for you.
It's a fascinating thing. And who knows where this conversation is going to end? Not our one, but the general conversation about the monarchy, because it's definitely stoked a lot of fire, isn't it, online, Dane?
I mean, it has. And I'm going to say myself, speaking completely subjectively, I still think this all is a large part of the constant destruction that has begun in earnest from about 2008, where a collection of people who are really referred to as the 1% or the haves are continuing to manipulate the emotions and the focus of the populace at large to make you people forget that they stole all the money from you. And they're going to keep throwing these distractions in your face until you realize who is the real issue. And that's all it is, I think. Because it doesn't matter. Like, at the end of the day, the Queen's holdings and Queen's earnings at this particular point means that she'd be able to provide cover and care for her family for years to come. Evidenced by the fact that even Princess Diana herself had made sure, as a part of her legacy, she had left enough investment so that there'd be a financial base to provide care and nurturing for her children. You know, that goes
10 million each, if you're wondering.
There you go, 10 million each. And you know what? More power, I guess, to her if she had it. In the same way that the Queen, the Duke of Cornwall alone, who is not, you don't see in the pictures of the Queen, but the Duke of Cornwall, who is obviously related, his property portfolio is worth 8.3 billion. And that's just the Duke of Cornwall. So I'm just saying that, you know, in the interest of, you know, being a lot more moderate in dealing with right-wing discourse or even in support of a free economy, I think we should cut them off. I think they've done well enough. I think I'd say my other idea was, if we have a real issue with tourism, why not leave it open like an election for someone to be a regent?
No, sounds
if
fun.
You knew you could buy the equivalent of a raffle ticket or a lottery ticket and you could you could serve as this country's sovereign for 4 years.
Oh, lots of fun. That's a great TV show. Let's do it.
You know, we will have Gemma Collins as queen for the next 50 years. Are you ready for that?
That's what people vote for.
Sorry, not Gemma Collins. Sorry, the GC.
The GC
would be queen.
GC, and if people vote for that, that's what they vote for. I reckon we'd get a lot more bank holidays out of Gemma Collins. Golden Jubilee, it'd be golden, but it'd be white as well, Russell. You know what I mean?
On that bombshell,
this
Dave.
This is my speech, babe. I'm a diva, deal with it. I run the country, darling.
But you know what? With that being said, for those people who are so outspoken about having a secular society, or those who follow Darwinist doctrine, there is no reason why Gemma Collins would not be predisposed to be a monarch any more than anybody else genetically. So I look at it as that we are...
That's a good question. Is Gemma Collins genetically disposed to be a monarch?
She can be a queen of something. How about that? Everyone's a queen of something, I guess.
Is that going to be your question today, Dane, or have you got something else? thank you for answering mine, though. I enjoyed listening to that immensely.
Can I just say, just for you, just the little thing that Dane said there, this is one of my favourite facts, is that if we were to become a secular country tomorrow, right, and we all stop believing in God, the life expectancy of a large swathe of the population would go down. So it's one of my favourite facts to make atheists like myself uncomfortable is the one thing you can do to add 4 to 5 years of life now without changing your diet or exercise is to start believing in God, as by all measures, they outlive atheists by 4 to 5 years in men, 2 to 3 years in women. Mm. Every single country, every single religion.
I completely believe that. I can actually believe that. And I don't necessarily know if there is a spiritual or metaphysical reason for that, but I would say maybe psychologically that...
It's psychological, yeah. It's human. We're supposed to check in with each other. Imagine if me and you every Sunday, I was like, you're right, you've got enough money, how's your wife? And when there was something bringing us together. Human beings are programmed to check in with each other, sit next to each other, absolutely, break bread together.
Yeah.
And religion forces you to do that once a week.
Well, or religion more is politicization of that ideal that human beings, we are a social species. So our, what's the word I'm looking for? Our collective well-being is something we should observe anyway. All that's happened is that is a natural inclination of human beings, just as a social species, that the progenitors of modern day, or even religion in general, were aware of and were able to capitalize on. In the same way that people know that for most, I would say this, for example, most women who are part of the workforce probably don't have the same time they would like to observe sort of elements of their femininity. Like, that's why they have to put the makeup on the train. People are aware of this, but rather than being like, we need to provide a industrial environment whereby women's face aren't, you know, subject to the same level of toxification from working in the big smoke, they'll just sell you stuff that matters. In the same way that, like, we know that obesity kills more people than knife crime, but you have a sugar tax rather than addressing the issue. Because it's like, we could do something about it, but it's money to be made.
It is knife crime, but it's a cake slice. It's the knife.
Dane, I think it's time for your question on this week's episode. What have you got?
I mean, you fucking blew the podcast apart with a monarchy question.
I know, I know. It was deliberate. It was deliberate.
I hope Dane's is something like, is bread nice or something?
No, it's lovely.
To an extent, Russell, though, it's kind of like belies a real existential question. Do you remember there was a point? The best thing since sliced bread. Now everyone's gluten intolerant. So, you know,
what I mean?
It does speak about human evolution.
Right, so go on. What's the question?
My headphones came out. No, but the question is a big, I hope it all interlinks with all the previously discussed topics, because I would say, you know, under the subject, for example, on the subject of monarchy, for example, and even on the subject of privilege, these normally become heated exchanges, especially when you're juxtaposing the, the immigrant contingent or the diaspora and the white working class. And I say that because I feel what a lot of people fail to understand is that racism is not about what people say. It's what can actually be done. And I was doing a tour show last year where I had to make it very clear to people that it's one thing when you hear working class people tell you to go back to where you came from, but they are not the people that are hiding documents, destroying documents, falsifying them, and actually creating legislation to create the Windrush scandal. That would be the middle class people that are in parliament and your head of your home office. In the same way that at a time now where nomenclature used within comedy and in terms of identity politics is so, so, so sensitive. But when I started doing comedy, being able to call somebody a pikey or a scally or a chav, acceptable hatred towards the white working class was ubiquitous. And I say all that to say this, because obviously I feel like one of the parallels that you and I have, Russell, is that we have had an upbringing which would... I'd say our narrative, our speech patterns, the way we speak, kind of betray the reality of our upbringing. And maybe compared to a lot of our peers, we have the gift of being able to articulate that experience and deliver it in a way that people from outside of that socioeconomic class can understand. So it's like you can tell working class stories to middle class people. And as a result of which, I think you're the best person to answer this question.
Well, how big's your telly? Maybe that's a question.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, it's just a very simple question, because obviously just going through, you know, just the list of your achievements and your body of work, how have you found it as being a straight white working class man? Is like, you know, it is flippantly said that people are happily to negate your narrative and be like, well, it's a white working class, it's a straight white man. But, you know, there is obviously a distinct bit of nuance based on socioeconomics, if you are working class versus being middle class. I just wanted to know, how is that been for you? Have you been currently, and have there been any market changes of your experiences and interactions with stakeholders within the industry since these conversations have come to the fore?
Yes, lots. And quite rightly so. So we're all on like a learning journey where if you have grown up white and working class, that's the only journey you know. Up until I was about 13 or 14, I didn't even realise that there were other people that had substantially more than me. I just came in from school, went over the park, then started smoking weed over the park, then left school with shit without even getting A-levels. Didn't question it. I never was like, oh my God, I've been robbed by accident at my birth. Then around sort of 18, 19, I started to get a bit angry, redid my A-levels, got an A-grade sociology, worst A-level I could have done, so it made me even more angry. And then I went to uni and got an angry first. Since then, I've not been held back at all, apart from stuff that I now look back and was a bit inappropriate. Like, I suppose one of my first jobs, someone asked me to do something. I went, no problem at all, mate. And I was given a disciplinary for using the word mate by some possibly. I'm not trying to meet. Whereas looking back now, in 2021 term, I would have said, well, I'm allowed to say mate. That's my accent. That's my class. That's my identity. We say it to everyone. So to little things like that, where a lot of the people in my industry were posh. But as soon as I was out of a posh industry, jewellery, and into advertising, which is like stand-up, which is much more of a mix of people based on how creative they are. And unfortunately, posh elite people can't make themselves more creative. They can study art and they can get more breaks, but they can't actually have more unique ideas. They can't squeeze more out. So as soon as I was in an environment where I could be a copywriter and things like that, I've never felt held back by the fact I started life stuck in a council estate with shit opportunities. No one backed me. No one helped me go to university. I never had any of those things. And I always felt up until certainly at uni that if there was a room full of people who were like privately educated and they were speaking about Jane Austen, I would feel like I couldn't join in, even if I had better arguments because of the way I sounded. So I suppose you could make an analogy there with skin colouring, that you felt like, I felt like I didn't have a right to join the conversation because I was from working class background. Therefore, how could I know about posh things like literature? But I got over myself quite quickly. Well, I say quite quickly, by the time I was 25. And by then, I would say I've been treated very fairly in the industry. It's matched how funny I've been. I've had the right sort of breaks, and I've made several mistakes, which have cost me jobs, and I've done several things brilliantly, which have got me jobs, just like all stand-ups. The last 10 years, in my own work, in my own shows I make, not out of some tokenistic identity politics way, I'm interested in people that have different stories to me. That's where I come from. I know no one's going to believe it, but that is the God's honest truth. I'm nosy. If you're female and from Taiwan, I'm probably going to want to know your story more than I am Gary from Loughton, just because I don't know anything about girls from Taiwan. So I probably would want you on Evil Genius more, because it's going to make the program more interesting. So that's always been my attitude, is what provides more meaty, interesting content. Mm. So far as the specific question of, are you being told, sorry, you can't have the job because you're a white man and it's not representative enough? Of course, that's what all people are being told at the moment, and quite rightly so, because the balance is swinging the other way while the business is rebalanced. This is what I will say to anyone who might be angry listening to this sort of right-leaning. No one is suggesting don't give the job to a white person, only give it to a person of colour, or only give it to a woman. My suggestion would be, let's fill our shortlists and fill... I described it like being on the beach and we look in all these different rock pools for all these little different treasures when you're a kid. And for the last 30 years, some rock pools have just been ignored and they're full of little gems. They're full of funny voices or great writers or this and that. So all I'm saying is spend more time looking in the rock pools we weren't looking in before. I'm not saying only select from those rock pools, but you could spend double the time looking in them and then still go with Russell Kane, the white guy anyway, but you should have spent double, triple the time looking in previously ignored resources. Why? Because it makes comedy better. It makes literature better. It makes it more interesting.
This is one thing, Russell, that I've heard Dane, obviously we've done a few episodes of this show now, and Dane has often talked about the laziness in this industry at times, you know, and I work in this industry, so I can vouch for it. It's just not people just not putting their brain on to the level they should, because, you know, I can tell you, you know, Russell, when you're on a list, there aren't many Russell Canes on.
Not exactly. It's exactly that. And it's so strange to, like, was someone who's been so capable in so many incarnations of comedy formats. And then, you know, to try and see people trying to mimic the same thing who do not have what I believe to be a massive gift, especially given over the last 20 years where there was a accepted erasure of white working class men from British television. And that was justified under the pretense that, you know, people immediately associate racist rhetoric and misogyny and sexism with white working class men. When people are making references or we are critiquing and using nomenclature like catcalling and harassment, the tone that is displayed is always the white working class man. Even when most people close their eyes and they even ponder your quintessential racist, that's what they see, as a guy like, do you know what I mean? I've got tattoos and blah. But, you know, as you rightfully point out, Russell, the odds are that white people within the working class have much more interactions with people from more diverse backgrounds than the middle class gatekeepers that are, you know, having much more executive control.
This is what I hope our grandchildren will tune out. So when I talk about it in my book, Son of a Silverback, which is all about my daddies, if everyone whose voice is quieter than it should be based on privilege that is nothing to do with you. You can't change if you were born in a council estate. You can't change what colour you were born. You can't change what height you were born, come to mention it. So if we just all said, like, if there's a volume, and the Queen's volume is 100, and single mum from a BAME background in a tower block, her volume is zero, we're all born with a certain volume level based on what we're handed at the start. And so if all the people with quieter, I'm not like fucking getting my Corbyn drum out or anything, but if all the people with a quieter volume got together and stopped carving ourselves up, it would be a very, very powerful way to redistribute the voices and volume. I personally, I have to just read, I don't have any complaints with my workload or the exposure I'm getting in the industry ever. You will never hear me bitch. I'm very lucky. I'm working 7 days a week, but it does, as I say, boil my pit. You know, you'd be working with someone. I'm not thinking of anyone specifically here, but you'll go, oh, it's good to have someone of a more representative background. And you'll speak to Lottie. And yeah, okay, Lottie might be from a representative background, but her dad's a barrister. Her mum's a judge. Her grandma is a politician. Back in the country. I'm like, what the fuck?
Lottie went to Oxbridge herself, and she graduated cum sum lauda.
But it's like, oh, it's represent. And I'm like, does that really represent some of my friends of colour that I grew up?
And the other thing that comes in, one thing that does come up, and Dana's talked about this before, is this desire for people to put people in boxes. And one of those things comes down to age. Now, I watched all three series of your TV show, Russell, back on BBC Three, and I think
that's horrific.
That was a joy to witness that show. There were so many good acts on it, and I think it's just interesting thing that so often people are put in boxes. They're supposed to represent some kind of version of youth or something, and it's just not. It just doesn't to me make a lot of sense a lot of time. People can work it out for themselves, you know.
Dane asked a really important question. The pigeonholes have been set up, and some of the pigeonholes that have been set up are great. I'm all for more representation out of sheer nosiness, and also my privileged position of I haven't really got anything to threaten anymore because I'm sort of established. Even if I didn't do another minute of TV or radio in my entire life, I could probably tour little art centres in 20 years' time and still be fine. Do you know what I mean? So of course I'm going to back representation because I've sort of got to the top of my little bit of the ladder. But it's sometimes I think that the pigeonholes are too simplistic, or that we're offensively lumping people together that don't belong together. I mean, you see it all the time with the BAME argument. It's like, why are you lumping? So I don't just go, oh, Bangladeshi person, Jamaican person, same thing. I mean, to me, that I find that offensive. It's not for me to find to be offended, BAME, but I find that offensive.
Think about BAME, the acronym, the term. I mean, I was just having a conversation on the podcast yesterday about the term black alone. Like, I don't have, like, if we're talking about black and you're talking about black in terms of an aesthetic description of another person, well, then that, by that same token, a black would also include someone who is an Indigenous Australian from who lives in, like, you know, New South Wales, but also would include someone from Papua New Guinea, if you're talking about the aesthetic. I have nothing in common with these people. Other than, you know, apart from a political status, like, the term BAME, like even the term Asian, how are you even trying to compare a continent? Like, I'm sure that Uzbekistan is in the continent of Asia, but so is Taiwan. Those two cultures could not be further apart. Like, and so it's trying to work out how, like, the only thing people have in common, even with the LGBT community to an extent, the only thing people have in common is the grouping that they're under. That's the only thing they actually have in common, is the umbrella term in which they're grouped. Like, you know, you think about the implications for your life as a member of the T with, or being transgender within that community, as opposed to the implications of what it means to be gay, and then also the intersectionality of being gay, as well as dealing with all of the other racial and economic aspects of your being. You can't compare those two things. That's like apples and motherfucking planets. It's so far apart.
Dude,
well said.
I read a Carla's book recently, which is, I'd recommend to anyone. And so I learned a new verb that, well, I didn't learn it. I've just never heard, I sort of deploy it now. It's to be racialized. So the society you're in decides what you are. You don't, your genetics don't get to decide. And so I was, been making a program about Diego Maradona last week. Now, I didn't know he was racialized as black in his country. That was fucking news to me. But in Argentina, he described himself as a little black boy from the ghetto. So he was sort of a person of color in his home country. So we're racialized according to random pigeonholes that have been set up depending on the accident of where you've been born. In our case, the United Kingdom. Yeah. It's crazy. But yeah, the answer to your question is, Dane, yes, there's been changes. I back nearly all of them, but I do resent the idea of white man being this one homogenous concept.
Yeah, exactly. And that's exactly what I wanted to ask, because I feel like, I said, speaking to somebody like yourself, speak to somebody like Adele Strain, who has, you know, significantly different, very different, you know, political outlook versus someone like a Jeff Norcott. But it's like, you know, I feel like it's strange that, like, because, you know, and I think it's all down to a large conversation about this idea of trying to contextualize human existence along the line of an algorithm. And because this is, you know, and that, again, it's for capital purposes. This is why people make these declarations about themselves, in terms of when you see someone on social media, it's like, my name is this, I'm from here, this is how I identify sexually, these are the pronouns I want you to use. That way of quantifying your existence is not something you tend to do as a human being. If you could quantify what you're about so very easily as a human being, we wouldn't need the process of dating and courtship to get to know one another, because most people exist moderately within various different political ideologies. No one is really wholly binary anyway. We just contextualize ourselves that way on social media for the sake of algorithms, because then they know what kind of advertising, what kind of stories, what kind of manipulation can I suggest to this particular person based on the algorithm. But when how we exist in real life, that's not who we are. So, for example, I look at a comic I work with quite frequently on a radio show, Leo Kurse. Leo is an outspoken Tory. He's very right wing, very much against taxation and socialist structures. Well, I'm able to get on with Leo just fine. I can always have discourse with Leo that doesn't descend into any kind of name calling or insults or any kind of tension, because we're able to respect one another as individuals. But we need to look at our leanings on paper. You know, we would be diametrically opposed, and it would be like, if you put these two people in a room, you'd be like, we're putting two cats in a bag with, like, you know, a gram of Coke. And the real issue is just this idea that we are so focused on trying to make declarations based on what separates us from everybody else, rather than what kind of brings us together. So this is why it's like, I've said, for the white working class, there is this kind of real unified theory of racism and sexism that I don't believe is particularly accurate. But again, I just think it's one of these things that, rather than race-splain, it would be remiss of me, given my heritage, to really try to talk about the merit of myself as an observational comedian and social commentator if I'm not speaking to what is supposedly even a privileged group.
Yeah.
Brett Goldstein, who was a stand-up, I don't know if he still is, he's a writer now, he's taken that idea of algorithms and identities to the next level. So if you want the series Soulmates on Amazon Prime, very good. It's the idea that you register, it's like a Tinder of the future. You register yourself, like, and it just takes
episode, right?
He just takes all your identities and matches you with the soulmate you're supposed to be with. So it sort of takes that ad nauseum.
Lovely.
Do you know, the only one, like, when people put their IDs on and they go, like, I'm transgender, I grew up in Brazil, or but I'm from Jamaican background, I never resent you, because I sort of think that's really does explain a lot about how you've perceived the world and everything that's happened to you. The only one where I'm like, nah, fuck off, is when people, what's your identity? Well, I'm vegan. I'm like, listen, right? I'm a Green Party member, politics on the table. So no one backs veganism, even though I'm not strong enough to do it myself. I totally back it. Your identity isn't that you eat vegetables. There must be more to you than that.
No, but it's true. That's your diet. It's not your identity.
But it's identity.
I want to introduce myself and be like, my name is Dane Baptiste, aficionado of current buns.
But if I do, like, I'm doing daytime TV at the moment and I'm having to try and get jokes through, and I can do a joke that's slightly ironically sexist, no complaints. I can do a joke that might talk about Meghan and identity politics, no complaints. If I even drop one shade of an anti-vegan remark in, my Twitter lights up for 2 days and people go to Ofcom.
It's been another superb episode, Dane, hasn't it? We've managed to get through so much stuff, and I don't think when Russell said he was going to do the show, we had no doubt, right, Dane, that was going to be the case.
Oh, absolutely. As I said, it's always a pleasure, and I think you are one of the most important voices in our country, for sure.
Oh, fucking hell, man. Jesus, Dane, thanks.
No pressure, but I just think we're very much in a state of social flux, and I would be very eager to hear more about you opining on it. So thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
It's been amazing.
You know, I love your work. And congratulations on the series as well, Dane.
Oh, thank you so much. But I heard you got a book out. Please let listeners know where they can find more about your book.
Yeah, if you want to know about what it's like to grow up with a frustrated, knuckle-dragging, white working-class, right-wing dad, read Son of a Silverback. It's all about my old man.
That's something that our listeners can go and check out.
And also, please, and they can also check out the podcast as well, guys. So please check out Boys Don't Cry and Evil Genius.
Evil Genius, definitely.
If you want to talk about, you know, the moral fabric in which our society is built upon, then that is definitely the podcast for you.
Of course, Stand Up Sketch Show as well, which is on TV for the rest of March, I think, or something like.
Lovely.
Absolutely, guys. That
ITV2.
ITV2 weekly at, I believe, 10 p.m. So please check that out. And you can find Russell Payne there as well. And again, Russell, thank you so much.
Respect, Russell. My pleasure. Thank you, sir. And your height's perfect, mate. You don't need to worry about your height. You're smashing it.
Absolutely.
You've been listening to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything, hosted by Dane Baptiste. For more from Dane, go to danebaptiste.co.uk or follow him on Twitter at DaneBapTweets or Instagram at DaneSnapTeast. Our guest was Russell Kane. You can follow Russell on Twitter and Instagram at Russell_Kane. The show is produced by me, Howard Cohen. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram at TheHowardCohen. The show is mixed and mastered by Audio Culture. You can follow Audio Culture on Instagram at WeAreAudioCulture. Please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at DBQE Podcast. Thanks to Polly, Gelly and the Acast team for all their support. Thanks for listening, guys. And remember, question everything.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.